To the regular city council meeting. Would you all please rise? For a short private invocation, asking for God's blessing upon this city and wisdom for our city council as they make their decisions tonight. And now, if you'll please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Item 1D on our agenda is roll call, and tonight, City Councilman John Erickson has to be excused. Can I entertain a motion to excuse John Erickson from tonight's council?
I'll make that motion.
Second.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. Maria asked to be able to attend remotely. She's been carrying around some sickness. Maria, do you, are you present on the call tonight?
I am.
Thank you, Maria. So, next I'd like to move to item 1E, which is our citizen input. The segment of the city council meeting where citizens have the opportunity to address the city council. You have up to 5 minutes, and you would please raise your hand and I'll recognize you. Jake Mendez Jr., do you want to address the city council tonight?
Yes.
Please state your name and address for the record.
Good evening, I'm Jake Mendez Jr. I would like to please the city council in my opinion in regards of the Kiwanis Park. I did a press release of a video regarding the men's restroom and to get the community's feedback as regards as the sanitary state that it is right now. It's my honest opinion about it is it looks very disgusting. It really is. It does need work. It does need improvement. My only reason for this is that I hope this feedback turns into a positive outcome in the future for the people of the community of Othello to see it, that the city council and the city commissioners could do something positive about this and do something for to better the restrooms for both men and women. I understand the new restrooms do look nice. I appreciate the lighting. As far as the window goes, it brings in more natural light. That's what I like about it. As far as the main restrooms up where the playground is at, it does need to be upgraded. My only suggestion in this press release video that I released out there is the fact that the restrooms do need a self-flushing urinals. If possible, also hand-free soap and water, just sinks, so like that, it'd be better for the community to have more safe and sanitary ways to wash themselves, their hands and whatnot, and a better covering of the toilet papers as it's just open. The garbage can seems like a scene from Sesame Street. It's really outdated, it's really old. And that's my honest opinion to you, City Council. I would like to, in hopes that you guys agreed with the bonds or the money for it that you guys are getting, and I hope that it contributes to a better park for the restrooms at the Kiwanis Park. Thank you.
Thank you, Jake. Just for clarification, the city is applying for grant money to do the upgrades on Kiwanis Park. And the men's and women's bathroom is one of those items that we're applying for grant money, so stay tuned. In fact, that's also on our agenda tonight. So with that, is there anyone else tonight who would like to address the city council? Okay, hearing none, I'd like to move to item 2, which is the approval of tonight's agenda.
Make that motion.
Second.
We have a motion made and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Let's move to item three, which is our consent agenda.
I'll make a motion to approve the consent agenda.
Second.
Thank you. Is there any questions? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Moving right along to our current business, item 4A is the award of the railroad utility crossing project, and City Engineer Sean O'Brien is here to discuss that, the bid that went on that project.
Okay, Council, Mayor. This past week, we had a bid opening for our railroad utility crossing project. We received five bids. The low bid did have a mathematical error, which is a fairly common occurrence, but because there was that issue, the second bidder had talked about they were going to possibly try to challenge it and talk to you guys into throwing the bid out and going with the second bid. I don't believe he's pursued that, but still, we have this on the regular agenda. And so I'm here to present that. If anybody have any questions on the project.
So were the changes made in the bid form, the bid that we have in front of us?
The attached bid summary has the correct bids per the Washington State design standards.
Okay.
If there's
So the correction was made in multiplication?
Correct. It was a unit price, and their extended price did not match up. And in that case, the unit price prevails. So it did bring the low bidder's bid up by about $8,000, but they were $16,000 roughly prior to that. So did not change who the low bid was. This project is not currently completely budgeted in this year's budget, so there will be some budget adjustments to cover the sewer funds for this work.
City Council, any questions?
Well, just reviewing it.
If you go to that item, you can click on that. That far right up in the middle on the top. There you go.
So the numbers that are bolded, it's a little bit harder to tell on the screen, but item number 23 is where the mathematical error was.
And that's been corrected.
That has been corrected. So these numbers you will be looking to award the contract for the $535,379.
They're actually all very close.
For five bids, it was a very tight span, but it's a fairly straightforward project. We'll have to be completing this work over the weekends. The railroad won't let us take the track out until Thursday afternoon, and we have to have it back into service by, we're ready for them to put the track back into service by noon on Monday.
Is that going to shut down Moon Road?
Nope. We should be able to keep Moon Road going. We have talked with Tomer, Salvage, whatever the actual company, your wife, and we have talked with Public Works about opening up. The city has an access road for around the drainage pond, but opening that up for the couple of days where we would potentially delay traffic, but the contractor is required to keep the road open.
Is there any other questions, City Council? Okay, so the recommendation from staff is to award the bid to
Industrial Construction.
Washington Construction. I'd entertain a motion.
I'll make that motion.
Second.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. I'd like to move item 4B, which is Complete Streets Grant Agreement. And our grant writer administrator, Amelia Lemus, is here to inform the council about the grant that we've received and how that money is going to be spent.
Thank you. So we have received $400,000 for Complete Streets, and we're really excited because we're working with the Bellevue Beautification Committee to complete the Main Street pedestrian street lighting. And so we've allocated $320,000 for that. Just last Friday, Terry, myself, and Lynette, we walked down Main Street to see where the remainder of the light posts will be going. And in total, we will be installing 23 across five streets, right? So all the way from Seven, all the way to, yeah, blocks, Seven, all the way to Second Avenue, we're going to have about 23 lights that we're going to install. I did mention to the mayor that I'll go ahead and get a map ready, and I will send that to all of you via email, so you can kind of see exactly where that's going to go. We're also going to be installing some bilingual crosswalk features on our crosswalks along Main Street, which is going to be about $60,000, so it's going to be six of them. So $10,000 each pedestrian crosswalk. And then we are going to do a bike lanes restripe for $20,000, so.
What's that look like? I mean, because a crosswalk, you come up to on Main Street where there's a light, either have a hand stopping you or there's a person walking. So.
Right.
How does that transfer to bilingual?
So what we're going to go ahead and do, we're going to have audio now, and so it'll say it in English, and it'll also say it in Spanish, like go, don't go, walk, go, you know, go ahead. And so it just really depends on how we're going to make it, what it's going to say. I'm not sure if you have some input on that.
So the two Hawk systems have audio where it says you're crossing Main Street at Sixth Avenue. It's basically for vision impaired pedestrians, so that they know where they're at and where they're crossing at. And we will have those reprogrammed to do both languages, but the other intersections will take additional component in the cabinet, and then the speakers, replacing the PED buttons.
Okay, I just wanted to understand what it was. I don't.
Okay.
Understand how you would change the stop and the walk.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And then, like I mentioned, $20,000 for the bike lanes restripe, and right now we are working on an active transportation plan, which we also got a grant for by Quadco for $30,000. And it's going to be a bike pedestrian plan where we're going to be able to identify where in the city of Othello do we need bike lanes, where do we need better crosswalks, sidewalks. And so with that transportation plan or active transportation plan being completed, then we're going to be able to identify exactly where these bike lanes will go. But our initial thought is that they're going to go along Scootney and 7th Avenue, so that way it connects the south end to the north end all the way to Lions Park.
Now, will you have to remove on-street parking to do that?
No, it will not. It'll be on 7th and Scootney, we have a collector road, a wide road, but it's still just two lanes. What it'll take is that 18 to 20 foot lane and stripe a 5 foot bicycle lane between the parking lanes and the traveled way. So it will reduce the traffic, kind of squeeze it more into a 12 foot lane or so in the center of the road, and give you a wider cushion from the parked vehicles.
I understand.
So what's different about this grant from other ones that we've received is that they are going to just deposit the money as early as June 1st of this year, and we go ahead and just start the project. So it's not going to be on a reimbursable basis. Just at the end of the project, we do need to provide supportive evidence of us completing the projects. So I'm not sure if you want to say that.
Okay, so just... This city council for years has supported this Main Street pedestrian lighting project. It's allocated money to replace light poles, and they started, I can't believe it, but it started in 2007, so it was 15 years ago when they first started on 14th Avenue. And the beautification committee has continued to have auctions and help raise money for that project. And they've now gotten it to, they've improved it to 7th Avenue. And this is going to improve it to the corner of 2nd Avenue and Main. So Lenap was thrilled, and the group is thrilled. These you guys have talked to Lenap numerous times. You've been very supportive of this project. One of the things is that the city really didn't have the money to finish the project on their behalf. But Talia worked on this Complete Streets program and grant. How many nominations did we receive from the Complete Streets?
So there was 7 total that we could have gotten nominated for, and we got 4.
And so with that, this is how we were able to get this significant amount of money for the city to complete the project. So we're all thrilled. I know Lynette and her group, the Spurls, and the rest of the beautification committee are excited. And once this is all complete, I think the city council can be proud of the direction that we're taking this whole project. And that, I think we just need the council to approve the grant. Is that correct?
Yep, the award.
I'll make a motion to approve the Complete Streets Grant Agreement between the Transportation Improvement Board and the City of Othello.
Second.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
Yes.
Can we get the same light poles?
Yes.
All the
yes.
way?
Yep. It'll be identical all the way from 14th to 2nd. Now I'd like to move to item 4C, which is the approval of Resolution 2206 to apply for RCO grants this year for Kiwanis Park. Talia?
So we're really excited to finally be here again. Last year, in 2021, we were awarded all 3 grants, so the WWRP, LWCF, and the YAF for Lions Park. This year, we decided that we wanted to kind of change it up this time, and let's focus on Kiwanis Park. There's a lot already going on at Lions Park, projects to be done and completed there, so we wanted to focus on Kiwanis. So what we're going to do, we're going to apply for $280,000 for the YAF grant to develop a futsal court and renovate the existing restrooms at Kiwanis Park. 2, we're going to apply for $400,000 through the WWRP program and a $500,000 LWCF grant, which those two together will help us develop what we're calling a spray park, but it's going to be a splash pad at Kiwanis Park. We're going to add lighting all throughout the park, and we're going to renovate the walking trails. From speaking to our landscape architect engineer, it looks like right now we have about 9-foot wide walking trails, and we're going to try to widen them up to 14 feet, just like we are doing with the connectivity trails through Lions Park. So that's going to be very significant because it's now going to be a shared use path. And we're going to be able to have, different modes of transportation just kind of coming both ways, whether that be jogging, bicycling, skateboard, and so forth. I'll go ahead and send all of you the applications that we submit so you can see some of the images that we've captured of how much in need this park needs this renovation, especially the walk trails and the restroom renovation. So in total, with these 3 grants, it is going to require a city match of $170,000, $70,000 for YAF grant and $100,000 for the WWRP and LWCF grants. If we are successful, the 3 grants will award, if we're awarded them, will total $1.18 million. So.
Terrific. Thank you, Talia. So we need this resolution and authorization to apply for these grants. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Council, do you have any questions for Talia, or is there any clarifications you need? I think this is what we went over in the committee.
Yeah.
And what the committee had decided, the Park and Rec Committee.
There's been a lot of discussion with regard to what individual items to apply for, and I think we got it squared away to where we meet the satisfaction for the decisions being made on the grants.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a favorable recommendation.
Thank you.
So I'll make a motion to approve the resolution 2022-06, an applicant resolution authorizing related to applying for the three Washington State Recreation and Conservation Office grants.
I'll second that.
Thank you. Further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you, Talia. And now I'd like to move to item 4D, Open Public Meetings Act and Public Records Training for Elected Officials. And I have our city clerk, Tanya Morello. She's going to introduce our instructor tonight.
Good evening, council. From time to time, elected officials need a refresher on the Open Public Meetings Act and the Public Records Act, and that time is now. So I'd like to introduce Morgan Damereau. He's the Assistant Attorney General for the state of Washington. I've attended several public records trainings by Mr. Damereau, so I decided to request and invite him to come to Othello to do a training for us. This training will be good for 4 years. And with that said, Mr. Damereau.
Thank you. So, good evening, and thank you for inviting. There's supposed to be two of us here this evening, but my colleague ended up not feeling well, and with all things going on, I was like, no, I think she decided to stay home. So, unfortunately, you just get me tonight. But let me plug this back in. Apparently, I can't type tonight. Yeah, there we go.
And then we took that out.
So tonight we're going to be talking about a couple different things. We're going to be talking about the Open Public Meetings Act and the Public Records Act. The training that's going to be able to check both those boxes and move on. In terms of who we are and why we were asked to come talk with you, and I'm just going to assume Lucy is here next to me. We are the consultants for our office's Local Government Public Records Consultation Program, which is a mouthful. We really need to come up with a better title. So we're coming up with LGCP. We'll see if that sticks or not. But basically, we're a resource for local governments all over the state. We started with public records. And then a colleague of ours who decided to retire, when she left, we also started working a lot on OPMA. So happy to be here tonight talking about both of those. Can we try to play this material? So where we're going to go this evening, just a quick kind of foundation as to why this stuff matters, why people care about and what's the significance of open government transparency. Then we're going to go straight into the Open Public Meetings Act and then finish off with the PRA. Timing-wise, how much time did you, I just want to make sure I don't just keep going on and on where you're like, oh, just make him stop, please. Okay, perfect. So again, just to make your attorney happy, and also I feel like I have to give some kind of disclaimer being an attorney or what and whatnot, our goal is to give you information for educational purposes. You know, when you start talking about PRA cases and OPMA, sometimes the facts matter. Sometimes they matter a lot, sometimes they matter a little. Our goal tonight is to give you some tools to be able to issue spot. So when you see something, go, wait a second, Morgan said something about this, and then loop back with your clerk or call your attorney and have a conversation just to make sure you're not walking off the edge of the cliff, so to speak, and buying liability for the agency. Because it changes over time. Both these areas are litigated quite frequently. Every time the legislature is over in Olympia, they're making changes to these laws. This year, the session that just finished up, they did something they haven't done in a while. They went and did some changes to the OPMA, so we're going to be talking about those today. Well, this evening, and then we'll also talk about a few things with the PRA. And you know why you're doing this is because, like I said, our idea is to give you some guidance, some information, issue spots, so that you know when you're on your pathway going through this, you don't stumble off the trail and into thickets and into thorn bushes and whatnot. And another good reason for this, besides the fact that the RCW, so you have to have this training, is that when I talk with public records officers, I tell them that. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, in terms of when somebody's going to file a lawsuit against the agency. You may not have done anything wrong, but they can always file that lawsuit. Sometimes you do. There is a mistake, an error along the way. What agencies care about, what the courts care about when looking at these issues is, does the agency take it seriously? And training is a big factor in that. And being able to show that from top to bottom, council level, down to the public records officer, down to staff, that they all have some information about the Public Records Act, about the OPMA if required. I think it helps the courts understand that you're trying to get it right. This was an oops moment, so to speak, and not the, you know, every once in a while you find an agency that just seems to not care. And when those folks get into court, it doesn't go well. So that's the other good reason to talk about this. And you can kind of pick your reason why. I really like this quote from Justice Brandeis. You know, sunlight is the best disinfectant. If you talk with members of the public about, you know, why the council is doing what it's doing, why the agency is doing what it's doing, if they can't see kind of what we're relying on, see these meetings happening, seeing the records we're relying on, they'll start filling in the blanks. And the OPMA and the PRA are really designed to prevent that. They might not agree with what your decisions are. They might not agree with what the agency decides to do with each of the departments, but they can have to understand, then they can understand at least how you got there. Then it becomes a very different conversation. Another good reason, if you look at, and I just pulled some random headlines out of newspaper articles, think about, you know, if your public starts reading these kinds of headlines, they'll start wondering, what's the council doing? What's the city doing? Why can't they get this right? What else are they messing up? That kind of stuff. And so it helps you stay out of those kinds of headlines. And then there's another really good reason is, and these are PRA penalties. It does have financial costs to the agency if you get this stuff wrong. We'll talk about penalties for the OPMA. We'll talk about PRA penalties specifically, kind of in that range, what we've seen. The high water mark for PRA penalties right now is $2.6 million. Exactly. It's like, oh my goodness, that's a lot of money. And you know, it takes a lot to get there. That was not at this moment. That was, if you ever read the decision, it seemed like the judge was really tired of that agency, so to speak. The lowest we've seen is $14 against the Office of the Governor. That's an anomaly. It was upheld by the courts, but that's the range we're talking about. More commonly, what we see is $15,000 in penalties, $45,000 in attorney's fees, something like that when we're talking about PRA. And that's money that's coming out of your budgets. Your insurance companies are very likely not going to cover this. So think about what you wouldn't do with, you know, well, $14, okay, you can probably eat that in budget desk. But with $60,000, you got to make choices about what you're not going to do now. You were talking this evening about, you know, changes you want to make to the parks. That's a lot of the money in the grant money, the matching funds you need to come up with if you get that grant. Those are the kind of decisions you're going to be facing. So let's start off with the Open Public Meetings Act. I'm going to talk about this for probably about half an hour, so maybe right in that ballpark. And this includes this last session, 1329, the legislature just passed. There's some new provisions that agencies are going to have to adjust the way they do business and whatnot. As I'm talking to you this afternoon, or excuse me, this evening, please feel free to interrupt me. Ask questions, ask for clarification. Sometimes I'll say, you know, that's maybe a better question for your attorney. If I try to provide the answers and things as best I can. Big picture wise, so who does the OPMA apply? Spoiler alert, obviously it applies to you. That's why you're here, that's why you're taking this training. Just wanted to give you a little bit of sense. It applies to the governing body of the public agency, but it's not just you. If you have a committee that you established to do something on your behalf, and they actually have decision-making authority, the OPMA would follow basically them into their deliberations. If they're taking testimony, if they're conducting a hearing on your behalf, something like that, the OPMA would also follow into some of those proceedings. There are some differences depending upon if it's a land use or something like that, but think about that, particularly if it's something that you would normally do, would you ask a committee to take on, and they actually have decision-making authority. They've got to be cognizant of their OPMA requirements, making sure they're following through everything we're going to be talking about this evening. In terms of public agency, just to kind of give you the idea of what it is, you know, state boards, state commissions, local city, like the city of Othello, school districts, special purpose districts. It's a very broad definition, and again, it's that idea going back to that transparency, that the people have the right to see what it is we're doing. They'd be able to watch the deliberations. It, like I said, goes to a sub-agency, a subcommittee, if they have decision-making authority, and those types of things. So what's a meeting? This is something where I think we need to, you know, pay attention to. This is where some agencies, you know, from time to time find themselves in trouble. A meeting is any time that you all are taking action. So this evening, there's been a number of votes so far, that's taking action. The thing about it is, physical presence is not required. I mean, this is why I say you need to pay attention. Where I've seen agencies and agency leaders get in trouble is things like email, things like social media, where if all of you were friends on Facebook and you started talking about agency business in that context, that's a meeting because there's more than a quorum of you present. So there are seven council members. So four of you are in that conversation on Facebook or sharing an email. You now have a quorum. That's a hidden public meeting, basically, and you've now stepped afoul of the OPMA. Doesn't matter what you call it. Obviously, this is a council meeting this evening. That's an easy title. A work group would be the same thing. Study session. It's really about function. It's really about what it is that you're doing if you're doing the agency's business. Next thing about it, and I've heard reference to it a couple times this evening, that your grants person is going to be sending you some information. You can passively receive information without running afoul of the OPMA. Be careful about responding. Respond all. If I could change one thing in Microsoft, I would make that respond all button go away. But it's okay for you to receive information to bring back to your next meeting and things like that.
Morgan, could you give us a clarification on, because it's on meeting or retreat? So sometimes, you know, many of these, you know, hospital districts, cities, counties, you know, school boards, they want to go on a retreat. And so many times they go out of the jurisdiction, they go to some, you know, like a hotel or to a meeting place out of town. Do you have any guidance with that, with regard to that?
Make it a nice place. That's always a good choice. You know, there's nothing specific that says where the meeting has to happen. You can have meetings out of the jurisdiction, but you do still need to give notice of that. With where we are technology-wise now, one thing I would really encourage is to use like what you're doing tonight with the GoTo platform, rather, or Zoom, and make it available so people can see that meeting because they have the right to see what's going on. And if you start to, you know, if you decided to, from a fellow, to have your retreat at Ocean Shores, it might be nice to be on the coast for a couple of days and whatnot, but it's going to start, it's creating barriers to folks participating. I think a technical violation, it does have some optics to it as well. If you could give notice, you could be there. I would definitely use some of the new technologies we've been lucky enough to use for the last 2 years, and use some of those so people could watch what you're doing, not have to be isolated.
Thank you.
So you said, you know, it's a meeting is someplace where you're taking action. So what are we talking about there? And action is not just the vote. I've seen a number of votes here this evening. Action is the process. Action is from gavel to gavel. People get to see basically from the invocation this evening up until whenever we finish this evening. They get to see that entire process. It is public testimony, it's discussions, it's any debates you may have, all the way through to final action on a vote of a particular issue, something like that. If you went back to 1971, you'd see a change in the OPMA. Back before then, the OPMA was just the right to see that final vote. If you think back to 1971, that's when we had Watergate going on. We're coming out of the 60s. People are really starting to question what's going on with government. So it was kind of a nationwide kind of move to open the doors, to see the discussions. That's really where things happen. You understand how we get there. Versus, you know, just simply going, agree or yay, doesn't tell people a whole lot. That's really that's what the OPMA is designed to accomplish now, is they get to see all of that from start to finish, with the exception, the exception of executive sessions. There's some very specific reasons, we'll talk about those, as to why you can go out of the public's view. It's a very specific thing you need to be doing when you're doing those executive sessions. But I really think about it, it's not just, like I said, it's not the final vote, it's all the pieces that go into it, it's everything that you do to get to that point. Final action is, of course, what you anticipated. It's that final vote. Must be taken in public. Secret ballots aren't allowed. If you're following, there was some press with the city of Seattle a couple years ago now, where there was a question about was there secret ballots going on. It's basically, you can't write down your vote on a piece of paper. I talked with one agency where they were contemplating having all the council members email in the vote, yay or nay, because they were under a time crunch. That, it gives the appearance of a secret ballot because people can't see how you vote. The intention is to put that on the record next meeting. what we talked about, hey, maybe there's a better way to approach this, because people need to be able to see what it is that you're doing. So anytime you find yourself thinking about, here's how I feel about that, so if it's not happening in this context, if it's not happening in announced meetings, in an announced meeting, probably should stop. And think, okay, maybe there's a better way we should approach this. Maybe this is an opportunity for a special meeting, if it's something that we have to do, that's time is that's really urgent, something like that. Public attendance. Obviously, it's so nice to be, when we were offered to come talk with you this evening, part of the reason we jumped on the opportunity was, I'm so tired of talking to my computer screen into my camera. And so the opportunity to come and just talk with the live audience is so nice. And obviously, the public can attend. We're still operating under the Proclamation 2028-15, but as of, you know, the people have the right to see these meetings. Doesn't mean that it's the wild, wild west. You can set reasonable rules of conduct, and in the revisions that just came out to the OPMA, it specifically says that you can, the governing body can adopt generally applicable conditions reasonably necessary to protect public health or to protect against interruptions. I'm not quite sure what to do with that last piece, what their legislative intent behind it was. If you think back to the last 2 years, you can totally see how we got to this protect public health. There's been a lot of, if you look across the state, depending on where you are, lots of feelings about public attendance and masks and things like that. But this was adding some clarity that local governments can establish some basic rules that designed to maintain the integrity of the meetings. I know I've talked with one set of folks where they had people who were very passionate about masking, and they were in the meeting, a very large group, and so they actually ended up having to clear the room, and then the people who were very upset went outside and started banging on the windows, and they had to call the police to respond. That's the kind of thing it's designed. Luckily, that didn't happen very often, but there were those kinds of events, and this is kind of clarifying that that's okay. Another issue that comes up is the idea of cameras, tape recordings. Washington State, there's a two-party consent state, meaning two parties to a private conversation have to agree to be recorded. By definition, this is a public meeting. That doesn't apply. That means if one of the members of the public, and we see it more and more nowadays with smartphones, want to hold up their phone and record the entire meeting, that's okay. This is where the rules can come into play. Obviously, if a member of the public decided to run up and put their phone right in your face, Mr. Mayor, that's not okay. You can deal with that. But somebody respectfully sitting in the room recording, that's perfectly fine. Public comment. This is a huge change. If I was giving this training 2 months ago, 3 months ago, I would tell you that this bill passed pending that might pass, but as of that date, public comment wasn't required. As of June 9th, agencies will be required to take public comment prior to taking final action. At any regular meeting. A couple of weird components of this, and for some reason the legislature chose to add the word regular meeting into that. So we'll talk about a section in a minute. There are two types of meetings that typically happen. One's a regular meeting, one's a special meeting. It says that public comment is only required for regular meetings. I would encourage you to not read that literally, and to, if you have a special meeting, to also take public comment. I suspect we'll see some clarification language next legislative session. But it really goes with the intent. If you went back and read the purpose of the bill that passed, there was really a strong encouragement by the legislature to do a number of things. One is public comment, public participation. They really think there's a value to it. And obviously, I'm not going to argue against the legislature. I think you've heard one member of your public tonight. You commonly see that when there's a hot topic, something that the community is really passionate about. The other thing we saw is in this bill was encouraging, and they didn't require it, but encouraging folks, public agencies across the state, to continue to use the GoTo platform or the Zoom platform, continue to broadcast these meetings if it's feasible. I think probably you've seen this talking with folks around the state. There's been a huge uptick in public participation because of the fact, and I've done this at home. I've been sitting, cutting onions, making dinner, participating in a school board meeting. And so I think that does have a lot of good. But now, the specific what's changed now is you now take, before taking final action, you have to accept public comment. You have two choices of how you can accomplish that. You can do it orally, like we saw this evening, or you can accept written comment. It's kind of your choice as to which way you want to go with that. If you're going to take oral comment, a couple of things that the legislature added into the bill, You can still put guidelines in place. I saw that by practice, it looks like you have 5 minutes for public comment. Some agencies have three, then they kind of shorten. If the room was full and overflow was full, they might shorten that to 3 minutes or something like that. But you can put those kind of guidelines in place. You can limit public comment to issues not on the agenda. It depends on, that's kind of a decision you have to make. And I've seen agencies go both ways with that. The one thing you need also watch out for, if you're going to accept oral public comment and you have somebody who contacts the board and says, or your clerk and says, I have a disability, I have limited mobility, or any other reason that makes physical attendance difficult, which, what does that mean? Does that mean if I'm in Hawaii, obviously I can't get from Hawaii to the meeting. Physically attending a meeting is going to be a problem. If it's reasonably feasible, you need to make accommodations so those people can provide testimony remotely as well. And for something like that, when you're doing your agenda minutes, or excuse me, when you're putting out your agenda, that should be something on the agenda nowadays. And on the bottom it says, if you need, we're going to be accepting public comment on these issues. If you need accommodation, please contact me 24 hours in advance by 4 o'clock the day before the meeting, something like that, so that the clerk can set up that process. Same thing with written comment. You could also accept written comment. You can put reasonable rules in place. In terms of, 5 pages, something like that, so somebody doesn't submit to you War and Peace, or some people are very passionate about issues, because one thing that needs to happen is, if you're accepting written comment, then that needs to be distributed to the entire board. And I think a good practice, since the bill not required, not specifically in the bill, is make sure that's part of the minutes, so that if you do take written comment, if Mr. Mayor, if you're the one who's introducing that topic, as part of your introduction, you say, we got this, we submitted to the board as part of this, as part of the board package or something like that. Just before I move on, one question to come up is, how are you going to implement this if you're going to take oral comment? Is this going to be something that you do like this evening before the meeting, as the meeting is starting off, or is it going to be, are you going to do it issue by issue? I think one unintended consequence of this, if you look at the language, it's required for taking final action. If you look at the definition of final action, it's a vote, it's a consensus. And as I was watching it this evening, I saw a number of votes occur. One was before even the public comment took place, approval of the agenda. Those are all actions. And I think my guess is what the legislature really had in mind was the decision points. Things like, are you going to apply for a grant? Are you going to do these kind of business decisions? But the courts have typically will read the OPMA and the PRA very technically. And so I think you may have to readjust your agendas a little bit as to when do you accept public comment. Because if you're going to technically approval of the minutes from the last meeting, you're taking a vote of the board. That's taking consensus. Oddly enough, may have to accept public comment for that. I don't know that. And I have talked to one person who would wanted to make a public comment about the minutes from the prior board because they didn't think they were sufficient, but it is something you're going to have to do. You do have to have minutes. There is no specific format for those minutes. I'm a fan of, you should be able to understand generally what happened. I've seen some pretty cryptic minutes that I can barely understand that there was a meeting, and I've seen some that read like a transcript, which I feel sorry for the clerk having to keep those. But you do need to keep minutes. Like I said, there's no specific format with a couple of exceptions. One is if you're going into executive session now, you do have to record those in the minutes. I found most people were doing it anyways, but it's the legislature decided to clarify that for us. The other thing that should be in there is we can have remote meetings now. And if you're going to have remote meetings, then the minutes should reflect the access tools. If it's a website, if it's a phone number, whatever that is, just to prove that you did it right. Because the agencies are always on the line to prove that we did it right. And so make it easy, have them all reflected in the minutes. Another good idea, if you can do it, is, I know GoTo will do this, how many people participate? How many people were watching online? It's a quick notation to make, but it kind of proves that you got it right. And be ready to deal with technology that goes wrong. And when the Zoom decides to drop somebody off or GoTo decides to crash for a minute, be ready to pause, take a 5-minute recess while you rebuild the links and things like that. So what about interruptions, disruptions? this has been going on for a while, but the legislature has clarified that you can stop individuals from speaking if they're not recognized. So if somebody in the back of the room was to stand up and demand you take action, you can ask them to stop. And this has always been built into the OPMA, and there's a procedure for doing this. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but I recommend that, you know, working with your clerk, working with your attorney, someplace in the mayor's packet should be on the very last page with a note that says disruptions, what to do, what's a sequence. First is to try to deal with the individual. Then you can clear the room and invite the non-disruptive people back in. Or you can choose to adjourn this meeting with a very specific and move it someplace else. There's a process for this. But you always should have that playbook in mind, because the last thing you want to be doing is, oh my goodness, now what do we do? And hope you never have to use it, but it's a good thing to have in mind. Have that cheat sheet ready to go. And that goes with Zoom meetings as well. I'm noticing that we don't have any live at life. I can't see anybody who's watching us from home. That's pretty standard, just because if there, you know, people can put things up on a screen that in a moment you can't unsee it. We saw some really, you know, some Zoom bombing happening early in the pandemic that had to shut down meetings and things like that. So this is another thing you should be prepared for. So let's talk a little bit about the specifics. What is a regular meeting? It's the meeting you're doing here this evening. It's the one that happens occurring pursuant to your regular schedules. This is exactly the disruption we're talking about.
Sit down.
This is why I do much better with the lapel mics, because I have a habit of walking around too. So the regular meetings are like this one. It's the ones that happen on a regular basis. Before the regular meetings, you have to have your agenda available online. For very small agencies that don't have a website or don't have a website hosted on somebody else's servers, there's some exceptions to this. Driving in, I saw that the population of Othello right now was about 7,780-ish, depending on how the census goes. You're over the limit. So you have to post these 24 hours in advance. The good thing about that is you can modify that agenda. You know, the agenda you put out 24 hours in advance is your best guess at what you think you're going to do. Something may have come up. One of your council members may make a motion to add an agenda item. You can do that on a regular agenda, and you could put that all the way through to final action. You could add something, vote on it, be done with it that evening. That's a little bit different than special meetings, which we'll talk about in a second. The other good thing about it is it's specifically written in that if you don't get the agenda 100% correct, it's not a reason to overturn that action. Obviously, we encourage folks, try to get it right. Try not to modify the agendas a lot, because it just causes those optics issues and things like that. But you do have to do that 24 hours in advance. Special meetings. So these are all of the other meetings that you may have that aren't your regularly scheduled ones. This has the same 24-hour written notice. They could be called by your presiding officer. They could be called by a majority of the council members. That notice has to have what you'd expect, you know, time, place, the business to be transacted, what's the agenda. We'll be talking a little bit about the fact that we can have all remote meetings now. So whereas, you know, if you're having a special meeting here, you'd have to say special meeting in the council chambers. If it was going to be completely remote, you wouldn't have to, you'd have to post it here at the city hall. But say you, for some reason, this room was under renovation and you're using the school for your meetings for this time period. If it was going to be an all remote meeting and you weren't going to go to the school, you wouldn't have to go hang it on the school anyways, because nobody would be there. But you do need to, you still have to post it here at the city hall and post it online 24 hours in advance. Has to be given to each of you individually. Has to be given to a local newspaper if they have a standing request. They may not. This is something that is, I still run into it sometimes in some of the smaller jurisdictions in Eastern Washington, but by and large, it's not very prevalent, but it's something to watch out for. Obviously, as I said, post it on your agency's website, prominently displayed at the place you're going to be having the meeting. Best practice is also include those hyperlinks so people can watch it online, get the telephone numbers, things like that. So emergency meetings, there are this third kind of meeting that, you know, I've been practicing law for 25 years, and I've never done one of these. Emergency meetings are something really bad is going to happen if we don't act right now. There's going to be a significant loss of property, damage to property, loss of life, things like wildfire. The town of Malden, a couple of years ago, when they were facing their wildfires, that was an emergency situation for them. They could take what emergency steps were necessary. When Mount St. Helens erupted, a dam breaks, a levee breaks, something like that, where if we don't act now, we're going to have problems. The courts look at these very, very limited. The fact that if it's not something that, you know, it doesn't rise to that threshold, say it's a contract negotiations with your police force, and you need to ratify the agreement, that's not an emergency. That is something you can wait 24 hours for. It is really kind of the, we're talking cats and dogs living together, wrath of God kind of stuff. So this is brand new. This year, the legislature has given us some guidance around remote meetings. They encourage us to, like I said a couple minutes ago, they encourage us to make meetings available remotely. Huge public participation. We've seen spikes all over the state, people being able to watch these things and understand what it is that we're doing. Much like we've been dealing with due to the Proclamation 2028, there's a section of this bill that's actually effective right now that says if there's a declared emergency, you have choices. You can either have a completely remote meeting, and all of you could be, you know, participating in this meeting from your kitchen table or from your, you know, from your front deck and watching the sunset or that kind of thing. Or you have the option of having the council come be present and the public can be excluded. You have some very specific requirements before you cross this threshold. One is there has to be a declared emergency. This can be a locally declared emergency, state level. This could be federal declared emergency. That's the first piece. You'd have to make an affirmative decision, and it says the agency, so I'm not sure exactly who would make this call. I suspect it would be a conversation between like the mayor, the clerk, and your attorney talking about, okay, what is the emergency we're facing here? Can people get here? What's the safety issue? But you have to make a determination that you can't hold that meeting where it's safe for the public or for you to attend. Public must be able to listen, so you still have to have those remote options available, whether it's telephonic or go-to or whatever, provided that doesn't apply to executive sessions, so those private conversations you've had. And you have to include that how to participate in the meetings must be on that notice of the special meeting. So again, those phone numbers. Overlaying all this right now, we still have Proclamation 2028, which, you know, is where we have, you know, and there's a debate right now as to which is the lie. Is it the proclamation that's governing? Is it the statute that's governing? I think you've probably satisfied both of them, quite honestly, so you cannot worry about that. And your attorney doesn't have to stay awake trying to figure this out. But we're still operating under the proclamation, so you still obviously have to, you know, we can have public present again, which is very nice. Obviously, we can be present, but you still have to have those remote options, which I know that we have. So. Just when this is going to go away, you know, I can see it in the future. I just don't know what that timeline looks like at this point because of the changes we've seen in the law. But keep that in mind. We still have the proclamation. So executive sessions. You can go into executive session for very specific reasons. Those are set out in the statute. When I was working with my boards, my commissions, I would go back and I'd read that statute every time, and that's what I would have them put in their agendas. That's what I have to have them put in their meeting minutes. Quote that exact language, know exactly specifically why you're going in. When you're going into those executive sessions, you have to check a couple of boxes. One is that you have to make the announcement as to why you're going in. Again, that language. You have to tell folks how long you're going to go in, anticipating an executive session for 30 minutes. You can extend that time. And I know of people who have done this to an empty room, where the clerk of the board will come out and announce to basically chairs that the meeting's been extended for an additional 15 minutes. It's technical, but you still need to do it. It feels really silly when you do it, but also it should be reflected in your minutes, so you can prove that you did what you need to do. The legislature has added it this year that has to be in the minutes. We've been doing it that way for years and whatnot. So why can you go into executive session? I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them because they're very specific. It's kind of what you'd anticipate. If you're going in to purchase real estate, sale or lease of property, if there's a public bid contract that's going to cost you money if that debate happens in public, evaluate qualifications for an applicant for public employment. So if you were hiring a new executive director for this for the city or something like that, you could go into executive session to have a conversation about, do we think Bob is, how do we feel about Bob's qualifications? How do we feel about Margaret's qualifications? You can't make final decision in there. The final decision has to be made in open session. You also have to have any discussions of salary in those contexts in open session. You can't come out and then just say, okay, so we're going to pay them $200,000 a year or $50,000 a year. Those conversations have to happen in public. Also, you can go into executive session to have conversations with your attorney, but it actually has to be for getting legal advice. You can't just have the attorney sitting in the corner because you're trying to, you know, make them a potted plant. It has to be for that purpose. It has to be for some kind of anticipated litigation, actual litigation. And having that conversation in public would be detrimental to the city. Not real surprising, obviously, if you're facing a tort suit and the attorney is briefing the council as to where your liability is, yeah, you don't want to have that conversation in public because opposing counsel might be sitting in the audience going, oh, this is great. That kind of thing. You can, but you always go back and look at the statute. That's your best, that's your starting point for all of these. So OPMA penalties. This is the part that's it's scary a little bit. These are personal penalties. So if you get this for knowing violation of the OPMA, your first knowing violation is $500. Each subsequent violation is $1,000 personal liability. This isn't something paid by the agency. Agency is still going to pay attorney's fees on this. And then more notably, the courts could overturn your decisions. They could say that you had to go back and do it all over again. So think about if there was a contract you'd approved, that thing is negated because you didn't follow the process. Is that going to leave you in limbo? What happens if there's been an increase in material costs? Are you going to be able to enter in the same contract, or now you're going to be able to get pay more? If you've done any construction work recently, you know, cost of lumber has been up and down depending upon the day. So those are the kinds of things you could be facing. So if you need assistance with this, best for me. I'm happy to talk about the OPMA resource. Talk with your clerk. I know she's well versed in it. Talk with your attorney. Take advantage of all those tools. Have a plan going in. So with that, let's switch gears. Let's talk about, how are we doing time-wise? Okay. Let's talk about the Public Records Act. So I'm just going to give you a little bit of a flavor as to what your agency has to do. You've got to appoint your public records officer, and I didn't look, but I'm guessing, are you the PRO? I'm sorry. It's a lot of responsibilities. I mean, I like this topic. 5 years ago, I was doing labor and employment law for the state and got a chance to stand up this program and voted myself onto the public records island, for which people think I've got to be nuts. Why would I do that to myself? Because I like doing this. I like being proactively working with folks, helping them to get it right. So you have to have a PRO. You have to have an agency policy, which I know you have. And you should look at it for every couple of years, make sure it still matches what the law says, how it is you're processing public records, because it's your playbook. This is how your opportunity to tell people what they need to do. How should they make public records requests? What do they need to do to, you know, how much time do they have to inspect public records? 30 days is pretty common. If you're going to charge for public records because you have to have a fee schedule, how fast do they have to pay? Again, 30 days is pretty standard in that regards, because by giving them notice of what the requesters need to do, if they don't do it, you can close a lot of public records requests. There's lots of requesters that ask records because they're really interested in that moment, and 3 weeks later, they're really interested in something else. And so when you say, okay, your records are ready, you know, give us $4 and we'll give you your records, they don't want to give you $4 anymore. So that's the kind of things that need to be in your policy. An index needs to be in there. What are your regular business hours? You have to be open for inspection 30 hours a week. City of Mesa, down just kind of southeast of here, got in trouble more than a few years ago now, where they told one of their requesters that you can only come in for an hour a week. Code specifically says 30 hours a week. Good news is that most requesters don't want to spend that much quality time in your offices, but it does take your staff, and that's what matters. The Squim School District is now getting monthly reports from the public records officer as to how many public records requests they get, the staff time and the cost every month for doing public records, because the council, the city, the school board is trying to figure out, are they properly staffed to do this? Because it takes a lot of resources to process public records. And then you also have to maintain a log of all your public records requests. Because all public records requests and this log is a public record unto itself and whatnot. So what is a public record? We could have given you the statutory definition, put lots of text up on the screen, but that gets really kind of dry really fast. So we built this to kind of give you a visual representation of what a public record is. It's got to be a writing, and before you think, oh, sweet, that's just paper. No, that was the 1972 version. It's any way we communicate. So comments about text messages, email, databases, voicemail can be a public record. Any way we communicate information fits within that definition. Nobody really challenges that piece anymore. It's got to be related to the conduct of government, a proprietary function of the government. I know the city has garbage services. That's a proprietary function. It's something you're doing. Decisions about the parks, about awarding the contract for the railroad grade crossing. That's related to the conduct of government. That's all public records. All the emails that go back and forth about that decision, if somebody wanted a copy of those, they're entitled to it. If it also meets this third definition, something prepared, owned, used, or retained. Good way to remember that is POR from the first letter of those. So again, that's, you know, all the emails that are sent by staff, by you having to do with your position as a council member. If you hire an engineering firm to come in and do an engineering report or soils report or something like that, you own that report. That's a public record. Something you've used in your decision-making process. So we see this from time to time where a council member will be discussing something and from the dais they'll say, you know, I saw this report online from the University of Washington and it was talking about blah, blah, blah. If it's part of your decision-making process, you've used that record, that's a public record. Really puts the PRO in a spot when they get the public records requests for those kinds of things and how do you figure out what it was. So keep in mind when you're, if you find yourself having that, making those kind of sentences, making those statements, keep track of what it was, send a link to your PRO, it'll make her much happier if she has to find it later. And it's all the things that you retain. So I'm not sure how old your email is and how long you've been sitting on council, but if you have records that you could have, so there's records retention schedules for everything. There's how quickly you can get rid of stuff. And if the retention schedule is for an email of 6 years, and you've been on council for 15 and you have 15 years of emails, that's a public record. Even though you could have gotten rid of it and you've retained it, if there's a public records request asking for it, you've got to produce it. Where we've seen this develop most recently is private devices. And so I really hope that all of you have City of Othello email addresses and that all your work is being handled through those in your capacity as council members. Because if you're using your personal devices, text messages, social media, then those public records could be lurking in your private devices. And so how do you know if it's a public record? I mean, I'm assuming that you all have, you know, I think everybody has a smartphone nowadays, and so you're getting text messages, you probably all have individual email accounts. So the question is, how do you know if it's part of the, if it's a public record? The question is it done within the scope of your employment, the scope of your job as a council member? So if your job requires it, if your employer directed you to do it, as council members, I don't think there is nobody's going to tell you what to do, which is where the third one comes into play. If it furthers your employer's interests, so if it furthers something the city is doing, then it's a public record. The courts always look to content. They don't care where it is. And so I really encourage, this is coming back to that, I really encourage folks not to use their personal emails, not to use personal devices, text messages. I carry two phones for work for that exact reason, and I won't cross the stream in that regards, because the bottom line is all these records are not yours. And so, I don't, you know, as you sit here on council, that's great, and you're doing a lot of good for the city. At some point, you know, are you going to decide not to run again? What happens to those public records? They still belong to the agency. And so this is where I'm a bit paranoid about these things. And why I really encourage folks to let their public records related to your job as council live in your agency servers, because you don't want to take on that responsibility. If you were using your personal devices and there was a public records request for something you had, you've now got the responsibility to search for it, to pull it off of your email, to pull it off your text messages, pull it off your Facebook account, wherever it may be, versus if you leave that in the city systems, the city will likely do that for you. I suspect your IT department, your clerk, is going to work cooperatively to make that happen versus you taking on that responsibility. You also, at some point, may have to do an affidavit that says to the court, if you get litigated over, if you're in litigation over this, here's what I did. So this goes to record keeping, which we'll talk about in a minute, but you should, you know, let's assume that, I'll pick on the mayor for a second, that you're using your personal email account and that there was a records request. You did that search and you asked and you sent what you found to the clerk. And the other thing I would recommend doing is sending an email at the same time saying, here's what I did. Here's the search terms I used. Here's the date range. Here's what I did to get the records off. Here's what I found that was responsive. Here's what I found that wasn't responsive. Here's the difference. Because you, I guarantee, if you're in litigation a year from now with this, you will not remember what you did. You'll remember that you did it, but the details will be lost. And we're talking about PRA litigation. It's always on the agency to get it right, to prove you did what you needed to do. And so that's why, first recommendation, just don't do it. And second, if you do it, if you have to do it for some reason, and you end up having to produce these records, keep good record, good documentation of what you did. And like I said, I'm not going to go too far into records retention this evening, but keep in mind that all records have a lifespan, and the record retention schedules, it's your authority to get rid of stuff. And I encourage folks to get rid of stuff as quickly as you can within the scope of these schedules. I talked to an engineer who worked for an agency who had 25 years of calculations, because one calculation led to another calculation to another calculation. And basically what it was doing was causing the public records officer to sit in her office and bang her head against the wall, because all this stuff was responsive to public records requests. And you couldn't understand that you didn't need to save all of this. I might need this someday, was what was going on in his head. Don't fall victim to that. Make it, you know, if there's things you think you're going to need, like a copy of an insurance policy that the city has, yeah, save that. City of Port Angeles kept an old copy of an insurance policy that covered for environmental cleanup. And so there's a huge cleanup project, which the insurance company is now paying for because they intentionally saved that record. But all of the other emails about Home Depot, excuse me, Office Depot and paper on sale, get rid of that stuff. Things that you don't have to save. A lot of things, particularly at the council level, Secretary of State's office will take from you after 6 years. Transfer at that point, make that issue the Secretary of State's problem. Don't save a copy of it. That way, when you get a public records request, the response from the city is, we no longer maintain that record. It's been transferred to Secretary of State's office. Please go talk to them. There's nothing, if you want to see public records requests go really, really tediously poorly, it's save everything. And have, it's a public records request could be, I want all of the mayor's email for the last 10 years. And if you've got it, you've got to produce it. And that's staff time that is not going to be spent doing other things. So what does PRA request look like? There is no official format that's required. They don't have to cite the PRA. They don't have to know the secret handshake. It's kind of, if it looks like a duck and if it quacks like a duck, does it look like they're asking for records? And you may get one of these in your agency email. Best practice when you get one of those is don't think about it. Instantly forward it to your public records officer. 6 months ago, there was a case that came out of Division II of the Court of Appeals that said that a request that came to the attorneys for their agency was a public records request, even though the city's policy said that it had to be given to the PRO. And the Court of Appeals didn't care. What the Court of Appeals cared about was, kind of not overly surprising, went back to that idea of what's a public record. They cared about what does it look like? Who's the requester? Does it look like they're asking for records? We don't care that it didn't come in the right door, so to speak. And it's very likely, as council members, you're going to see some of these from your constituents. Pass that along to your public records officer, because within 5 business days, she has to be able to send out an acknowledgement letter saying, at least thank you very much, we received this request. Of course, if you can do something more, if you can get the records out, that's great. And if you miss that 5-day deadline, you're already off on a bad footing in PRA. And you've already had a de facto violation of the PRA. And so this is one of those things. Yes, Mr. Mayor.
So at the top, and I'm in Walmart, and somebody's talking to me about swimming pool. and starts asking me questions about the swimming pool, and then says, you guys have any information about what the city spent last year on the swimming pool, as an example?
So the nice thing about your example, thank you, is that the public records request process is their ability to get records. You don't have to provide information to answer questions. So that sound, your scenario sounds like it's an information request. They want to know something. It's borderline to a public right to a PRA request because you probably do have a budget or you probably have council. Elected officials are difficult, not just because you're elected official, by the way, but because when you're here, you're sitting in your official capacity. But you also probably do things in the community outside of this in that official capacity. You always are the mayor, but you're always not the mayor. There is times when you're just in Walmart shopping, and you might engage with somebody. How I would handle that one is, if you know the person, say, you know, I'm sure there is something, send it this way. Ask the person to contact the public records officer on Monday. If they're insistent, then, probably know who the person is. Then I would, when you're done with the conversation, send a quick email that says, hey, I just had this conversation. I ran into Margaret. Margaret was looking for this information. In small communities, it's much more readily available. It happens more. Just because it's one of the great things and one of the unfortunate things about this whole community.
So this fictional Margaret, she can do an oral public records request?
She can. So
in other words, there's no requirement of being in writing.
There's no requirement of being in writing. The courts have recognized there's some inherent ambiguity in that, because what I say versus what you hear versus what I intended versus your interpretation of it, we could chase our tail for quite a while. And so you can always ask people to put it in writing. Some people won't do it, which is why, that's what comes to the public records officer to follow up and say, thank you very much. I understand you had a conversation with the mayor at Walmart and you requested the following records. Take the ambiguity out of it. But yeah, they can make oral requests. The nice thing about it is, particularly, and this is also the good thing about smaller communities, is people understand the lanes and they're like, I'm happy to. You've got some of that. You may run into somebody who doesn't like you, though, and so they're adamant or that kind of thing. Some of the, every agency ultimately at some point in time has their frequent flyer, their best friend, who just peppers them with public records requests. Sometimes it's the former disgruntled employee who is a former employee, not necessarily by choice, because you always like to believe that public records requests are made with good intent. And 99% of the times they are, but you always have to think about that 1%. And there are folks that there's at least one person in the state that has made over $1 million off of public records requests, because it's a pretty standard kind of request that he makes. I'll talk about it in a second, but you always have to pay attention to that.
This request can be made by 16-year-old.
The question was, what about the 16-year-old? You have summer staff that works at the pool, lifeguard. The Court of Appeals looked at was, how is the request submitted? What are they asking for? I think as it develops, we're going to see kind of a continuum. A request coming to the 16-year-old kid out there with a weed eater who's just helping mow down the grass. Court might not think that's a public records request. You should still give all your employees 15 minutes of fear, basically. New employee orientations, you'd be like, if you hear anything close to this, here's what you do. I think part of what happened with the case that said that when it went to the attorneys and the attorneys didn't do anything with it for 9 months, I think because of who got it, that was a factor. I think if it went to a council member, you're all going to be held to a higher standard because of who you are, the position you sit in. I'm speculating a little bit there, but I think from your perspective, be cognizant of it. So if somebody does walk up in Walmart, Morgan talks to you and says, no, I just is very passionate at that moment. Yeah, I would finish off. I would finish off because the other thing that concerns me is law enforcement. They're on staff 24/7, but those aren't normal business hours. That's the other thing, and whatnot. Chief was out of the room, so he didn't hear that. I was just talking about your officers being 24/7. That's the other piece that scares me about public records, is they're always on duty. I wasn't saying bad things about them. So generally, just to give you a flavor of what it looks like, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but we talk with a lot of people about building a repeatable, defensible PRA process, where every request walks this same pathway. You don't want to be every time going, now what do I do? How many PRA requests did the city get last year? Who are you on the spot? 21? Yeah. That's not bad. That's, you know, for a city this size, that's pretty standard.
So I don't think that included.
Yeah, happy to.
So must request identifiable public records.
Oh, thank you.
So a conversation in Walmart and somebody seeking to find out information on the
swimming pool.
Yeah, the swimming pool, what we spent. It's got to be identifiable. They've got to, I mean, should Sean sit there and say, well, tell me exactly what you're talking about? What we've spent numerous amounts of money over the years on the swimming pool. What specifically are you looking for?
You know, and you're exactly right. That's a good conversation to have. The question is, what's the best way to have that conversation? You know, if the mayor is having that conversation, is starting down that pathway, my first thought would be, let's see if I can take myself out of the equation and say, hey, it sounds like you really have some interest in this, but there's going to be lots of questions. We want to make sure we get you what you're asking for Monday morning or tomorrow morning. Give the PRO a call, give the clerk a call, talk it through, help in. You can talk with folks about, you know, what is it they're trying to request, what is it they want. Some people are amazingly passionate and will spin around so fast that you won't know what they're asking for, but they do have to ask for. That's one of the few requirements on the requester community, is they have to request identifiable records. Something that we have to be able to say, oh, we understand the world of the records you're looking for, and that kind of thing. So if they were just asking all kinds of random questions, they may have not gotten to a public records request yet.
So because you only have 5 days to reply, and they really haven't formally requested the information, really, I mean, and they haven't identified the specific
very possibly
record
yes.
that they're looking for.
Yes, very possibly.
Then how do you handle that?
Yeah, well,
so there is requests at Walmart, and you know that this person wants this information. He's going to let me know. I've been working with him for 5 days, and I will contact them. And at that point, I will ask them to be specific. And that's when my time frame begins for that request.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not.
It seems weird that we have to entertain that.
In your scenario, you're right. It's when the second conversation happens where the request gets framed as what that person is really looking for, that the 5 day clock starts to run, would be the argument. Not when that first conversation happened with the mayor. I'm super risk averse.
You may be giving the person something they don't even want. They don't even.
Very.
You know, they were just at the moment looking for something, you know, from the mayor in response to their feelings.
And maybe the conversation is sufficient, just, you know, having that conversation. Oh, yeah, there are records, and you can steer that towards, if you, you know, have a conversation, give us a call in the morning, or if it's still, business is still open, hey, give her a call right now, and walk through that process.
Just to be clear, they don't have to say, I'm requesting public records.
No, they don't. They don't have to say requesting public records. They don't have to cite the law. A lot of times they'll cite FOIA, the federal equivalent. Or just maybe a letter, an email that's received. You kind of have to see what the text is. Adding to some of the confusion is there's also lots of other reasons we give out records. We get subpoenas all the time. Employees have the right to see their personnel file once a year because under an LNI regulation. So there's lots of different reasons we give out records. And then I'm sure that, you know, people walk in all the time and asking for a copy of a building permit or a copy of their building permit because theirs got damaged on the site, or they want the application process. That doesn't look like a public records request. There's also this just doing business and that customer service. And so you kind of have to look at each one. Is this a public records request, or is this somebody trying to build a new house? And wants a copy of the pre-submittal paperwork or something like that. But each request is going to follow this general process. It's going to be kicked off by that request being received. And then within 5 days, it's 5 business days, You, you have to acknowledge the request at minimum, give the records out if you can. You have then, you know, typically what happens is searching for records. We'll talk about each of these a little bit more, because you're going to have some obligations of that likely. And then it comes back to reviewing and redacting records. And this is something I think a lot of people underappreciate. This is where a lot of labor gets taken, because somebody has to look at each of those records to make sure that protected information is not getting released. It might be as simple as a social security number, an employee's dates of birth, things like that, but this takes time. And then you finally move on to production. And if it's one of these large requests where people are wanting any and all, what's my example of one of the mayor's emails from the last 10 years, you may get into an installment loop because you don't have to give all the records at one time. You can give reasonable installments, 200 pages, 300 pages, 100 pages if it takes a lot to produce them, something like that, produced every 30 days, 20 days, depending upon the workload. And you may get stuck in this loop for a while. Yes, sir.
All means one's received and one's sent.
All means all, yes. So
I get email from all kinds of places
and
that I didn't want.
Good thing about those is you don't have to save all of your email. There are you know, I get emails from the Washington State Bar Association. It seems like every 3 hours. I delete those on a regular basis because I didn't ask them for them.
How about OpenGov?
That's one to watch out for. OpenGov is the group out of Florida. Is that the one? They're typically making a public records request. They want copies of contracts and things like that for last 3 months, 6 months. That's one I would forward on instantly. But again, look at the text. The example of paper on sale at Staples. Don't care. Delete. Things like that. Ultimately, you get to close the request. This may be something that happens quickly. It may be something that takes years to produce. The AG's office, we have been producing a request the individual wanted, all records with the word diabetes in it, which is, and you think about Diabetes Awareness Month, there are 1,400 employees for the AG's office alone, and they all get these emails. There may be a footer on an email. We've been producing that record, that request, for, like I said, 2 years. So I think we're close to being done. Not totally sure about that one, but it may take a very long time to produce these. So record search, I wanted to tell you, I talked a little bit about the third box there. And this is where, if we talk about litigation in the PRA, this is a common topic. There's always a challenge, not always, but there's commonly a challenge to, did the city, did the state agency, insert your local government here, did it do an adequate search? The nice thing about it is the courts have never said we have to find all the records. They recognize that electronics aren't infallible. Sometimes things don't pop up in a search. Sometimes paper gets put in the wrong file. What they have said to us is we have to look everywhere it's reasonably anticipated records are going to be found. So if it's email, obviously that's a common one. You can't just not look there. If you have a filing cabinet, there's a reason to think the records are going to be there. You have to look. You can't just look the one place where you think the record is, the place where it's most likely to be. You have to take the time to figure out, okay, what does this look like? And so we start talking about a public records request. One thing we encourage folks to do is stop for a second, actually, and think about it. What does the world look like? Where could these records be found? Use checklists. Use things to remind yourself where to look for records. If you have contractors that you've given copies of records to, do you need to go get those back from them? Plan that search out. Cast a wide net, because try to think of all those possibilities, and then keep track of what your search terms were. Keep track of where you searched. What was the date descriptions? All the nuts and bolts that go into thinking about where you might find records, because when you start talking to the court, and it's in the courts, the requester takes you to court and says, the agency didn't do it properly. They didn't do a proper search. The requester has to have some modicum of proof. They can't just throw this at the wall and hope it sticks. A lot of times what happens is two requesters will compare records and say, hey, I got this. Hey, I didn't get this. That'll be enough. And then the court's going to turn it to you and say, okay, agency, show me what you did. Show your work. The example I like is, when my daughter was learning math, she could see the answer really quickly. And so she would look at it and write down the number and then have to stop her and say, no, show me how you got there. Give me all the bits and pieces. The same kind of thing flows with public records. all of those steps, because you don't want to risk losing the judge. State Patrol won a case a while ago based upon the quality of its affidavits. There was an allegation. So a guy up in Seattle was convinced that State Patrol was using microwave emitters or some microwave surveillance technology to surveil him at nighttime. So he actually moved out of his house, and because he couldn't sleep, it was keeping him awake at nighttime. He was convinced of this. Moved into a series of hotels, still couldn't sleep, then made a public records request. And so one of the paragraphs, if I remember correctly, was that the State Patrol said, we don't use that technology at nighttime, which then made me question, okay, do they in the daytime? But putting that aside for a second, then went on for like 85 paragraphs about the search that they did, the databases they looked in, all the pieces to prove to the court that we don't have records that are responsive to this. And that's what the courts, that's what you need to be able to give to the court. Because if you put the dots too far apart, the picture you're trying to have the court draw may not be how they connect those dots. And so you really have to make that almost self-explanatory. Make it easy on the judges by giving them all these details. I want to give you just a flavor about exemptions, because a lot of this, you'll probably have specific questions as you, start working through public records requests, or if you have any tonight, I'm happy to talk about them. But there are hundreds of them in state law. There was over 500 in state law alone. And my brain does not store those. I know some of them off the top of my head from my experiences and things like that. But we have to be able to point to one of those. They could be in state law, they could be in federal law. So from time to time, we've cited treaties, international treaties, as to why records aren't being released. Because the starting point is records are presumed open. People have the right to see those records. And if we're going to hold something back, we can't just say, this is private. We have to be able to point to one of those exemptions that shows why they're not getting the record. The burden is, again, on the agency. This is the common theme in the PRA. It's always on the agency to prove that we did it right, or things like that. It's going to be your burden to prove if the agency is asserting one of those exemptions. They're narrowly construed, meaning that if there's an exemption in the PRA for Social Security numbers, which there is, it just means Social Security numbers. It doesn't mean EINs. There's a separate exemption for that. Even though those numbers accomplish the same thing, they're a tax reporting basis. But the courts are going to look at what's the specific language there. One common exemption that people like to think exists is, oh, this is just a draft document. There is no draft exemption. There is a deliberative process exemption for policymaking decisions. But if you have four drafts of a memo that then finally ended up with a final version, and you get a public records request for all records related to that decision, all four drafts and the final are responsive. There is no draft exemption. And you've got to be able to point to one of those, fight to one of those statutes that says, you are not getting this record. The agency has to give what's called an exemption law that says, basically, here's the legal basis for the record, for the exemption, and here's how it applies to this record. And there's where we see agencies getting in trouble from time to time is called silent withholding. If there is a responsive record that you are not producing, if you fail to tell the requester about it, that's silent withholding. Guaranteed, that's not going to go well in court. Basically, you can't just go, nope, nothing to see here, pretend it doesn't exist. You have to disclose all the responsive records, even if they're not going to get it. A couple specific exemptions. One is privacy. And this is one that catches a lot of people off guard. The Public Records Act basis for holding a record back because of privacy is very high. It has to be something that's highly offensive to a reasonable person and not a legitimate public concern. It has to satisfy both of those standards. There was a high water mark for this, and it was about 1978. One of my colleagues, who actually no longer is with the AG's office, used to joke with me about privacy in the PRA is dead. I don't think it's dead, but it's definitely on life support. It is an exceptionally high standard. It's the kind of thing that you only talk about with your spouse, with your partner, with your attorney, with your counselor, with your priest. It's that kind of thing that you hold very close to your existence, basically. It's not the stuff that you would have a conversation with a friend at a bar or at a picnic or something like that. It is a very core set of things that it applies to. It's also not a standalone exemption, so it has to be triggered by some other exemption. This is one that we see commonly for personnel records. Like I said, my history is 15 years of period of personnel litigation for the state, so this is one that I lived for about 15 years. Things in an employee's personnel file is privileged, is exempt from disclosure to the extent it would violate somebody's right to privacy. Things this covers is things like evaluations are covered by this right to privacy. Things like medical information would be covered by this right to privacy, as well as other exemptions you would apply to that. Let me give you a couple other examples. There are specific exemptions for employees' dates of birth. There are specific exemptions for employee home addresses, personal email address, personal phone numbers, things like that. As long as you're not using those in, like for email, if you start using your personal email for work, your email is going to get released. There's a case out of Monroe that covered that. But there are specific exemptions that cover that information. And so that's a common question. Employees are commonly wondering about, what about me? How much of my personal stuff is going to get out? As elected officials, I made a comment about evaluations are exempt from disclosure. Things like the chief of police, since he's with us this evening, the heads of agencies, typically like the superintendent of a school district, their evaluations are going to get released. There's a heightened standard for law enforcement that seems to be developing. There was a case out of East Wenatchee a couple of years ago now where application material that would have been normally exempt from disclosure, like my application to the AG's office 20 years ago now, that there's an exemption for that. But there was an officer in East Wenatchee that had been found to be dishonest. And because of the way that he was actually trying to become an officer with a different police force, that's how all this came to light. And the court said, because this is a police officer, what they do is more important, so to speak. Their authority gives them additional power. There's a heightened interest in what's going on. So the court said, we're going to look at law enforcement a little bit differently. So I'm anticipating some changes there. But you as elected leaders are held to a little higher standard as well. And so what's private for me as a regular employee or for your staff may not apply to you. It's going to be a fact by a very specific kind of basis. Still comfortable, your home address is exempt, your dates of birth, bank account numbers, all that kind of stuff is going to be exempt. So production of records, requesters can ask to inspect records. And I've made a comment a couple times this evening that this takes a lot of time to get them from exemption stage to production. It's where a lot of labor gets taken. Because they have to go through each of those records looking for each of those things. If it's a juvenile record, can you identify a juvenile from that record and things like that. But requesters can ask to inspect records. That's free. So all the staff time it takes to get that record ready for inspection is a cost of doing business. They can schedule time once we get out of Proclamation 2028 to come into the office, spend time with your public records officer or staff member, literally looking at records and reading through them, trying to figure out what they want. One question that commonly comes up is, what about them taking cell phone pictures? Because it's pretty common nowadays. Most agencies aren't fighting that because we can charge for the production of records, but it's to recoup our cost of producing records. It's not costing us anything for that agency, for that person to take that picture. I know of a few agencies that prohibit it. It's kind of a policy level decision you have to make. So that's free. People can come in. The other thing that can happen is, and this happens most commonly, is people just want a copy of the record. What commonly happens is either the entire record requested will be ready to go, or installment will be ready to go. We'll send them a letter saying, dear requester, records are ready. Please send us whatever your fee schedule says you're charging for records. Most agencies have adopted the defaults, but it may be that the number of records, that's $10, it may be $15. Send us that money within 30 days, and if you don't, we're going to close out the request. Same thing goes if they want to inspect records. Make an arrangement to inspect records within 30 days, or we're going to close this request. You can do that. You don't have to produce records forever and ever if the requester doesn't care anymore. But all this is in your policy, but it does give you, and that's one of the major tools we have to control requesters that are trying to take a pound of flesh out of the agency. Having that little bit of skin in the game is a huge difference. If they want the records, great, happy to produce them. But for folks that don't care, there's probably 1,000 other things your staff could be doing than producing records for a records request that the requester doesn't want anymore.
So we actually set our own fee schedule on for the records?
You can adopt your own fee schedule.
So if somebody asked for it in paper form?
I didn't look. I'm assuming you adopted the defaults, though. Is that correct? Is it 10 cents a page for scans, 15 for photocopies? So in 2017, the legislature did two things. There, you have the ability to do your own cost study, so you could determine what it costs your agency to produce records. 2017, they said, or you can adopt the default costs. All but four agencies I've known of have adopted their own, have adopted the defaults. It's based off the city of Seattle that did a cost study. And basically, it takes a lot of time and effort because literally, the city of Seattle did it. They had somebody keep track of the photocopier and literally watch somebody feed paper through the photocopier, how far. And so, but you could do that. Most agencies adopt the defaults.
So before you hand over the file or the...
We currently have not been charging for this electronic means.
Okay.
I mean, it's kind of the extent of it. I have yet to have to do that. It's just not that there's either electronic copies or it's just, you know, the
catalog. Yeah. But if someone requested paper copies of year 1980, everything that happened, I mean, you could be there for years doing that, and you're doing installments, but each time, they've got to bring you a check. You have an invoice, right? You invoice that. Yep. So if you want the papers,
you can charge
this amount.
Yeah, you can charge for paper if they actually wanted to photocopy it. If you had to scan it in to give it to them electronically, you could charge 10 cents a page for that. You could also charge 5 cents for every 4 attachments to an email, or 10 cents per gigabyte. So if there was a really massive request, you could those fees. If you were going to produce it on, say, a portable hard drive or a thumb drive, you could charge for the actual cost of that thumb drive or the CD that you produced it on. If you're going to mail it, the mailing in the padded envelope that you put the CD in, you can pass all those direct final costs on. Most agencies, it sounds like you're doing it. There's at some point where, you know, trying to recoup 10 cents for a piece of paper is just not effective staff time. And so most agencies develop a practice and you have to treat all requesters the same. And so they say, we're not going to charge for less than 100 pieces of paper or anything less than a dollar or something like that, because it costs more to invoice for that 10 cents than you're ever going to get out of it. And you can produce records electronically, and a lot of agencies are doing that, where they are, you know, through FTP sites or through email. The one caution that we have with emailing records out is watch for size limitations, because, you know, some servers don't allow certain sizes in. And so it's more a function of how you're going to produce, looking for options. So back to the scary part and the 15 minutes of fear. The high water mark was $2.6 million, city of Tacoma. They replaced their other high water mark of $1.7 million. I'm not sure, you know, why they thought they had to outdo themselves. But in that case, is on appeal. It's been remanded back for reconsideration of those penalties. But still, even if we go with the old number of $1.6 million, $1.7 million, that's still a lot of money. Because the court has discretion to set those penalties per document. And commonly what we see that as a per page kind of penalty. But it can be anywhere between $0 to $100 per page per record. Which is why some requesters will make a records request and then they will wait. The gentleman I mentioned that has made over $1 million, he will make a public records request, and then if he thinks the agency got it wrong, 11 months later will file a lawsuit, because every day that wheel goes around, ching, ching, ching. And you know, there's been, and this is up to the discretion of the court, and as long as the court has a rational basis for assigning it, you're not going to get the Court of Appeals to overturn that very likely. We saw a couple cases last year where the court sent it back to take another look, but that doesn't happen very often. But the real takeaway is we're talking real money, and it could be, you know, they had a case that they admitted they had a mistake. They had a public records officer who just wasn't doing her job. She basically retired but hadn't left yet. And so didn't follow the breadcrumbs that you see, you know, in reading a police report. It referenced that there were photographs and that there were statements. She didn't go looking for those. And so that got into PRA litigation. They admitted the violation, and so the penalties were $15,000. The attorney's fees were $45,000.
To whom?
That goes to the requester, and the requester doesn't have to prove they were harmed in any way. It's all about, did the agency get it right? They don't have to prove that there was any adverse reaction. It's really strict liability for the agency. And the idea behind the penalties is it's an encouragement to you getting it right the next time. And I don't do this, you know, when I'm talking with, you know, staff about public records, I talk about, you know, how would you feel if instead of me standing here, one of them had to stand in front of this council and explain to the council why they were cutting a check for $15,000 to a requester and $45,000 to the attorney because they didn't bother searching for records, because they didn't take it seriously. Because it has real implications. So big picture wise, touchstones and the takeaway from this is, you know, obviously public records are open. People have the right to see what it is that we're relying upon. They get to see our records. And if we're going to withhold something, there has to be a specific exemption for it. Those exemptions are narrowly construed. It has to specifically say a social security number, an employee identification number. Not exempt records must be disclosed. Location doesn't matter. Just to go back to the please don't use your personal accounts. If this means a policy shift for the agency, really encourage agencies to take this on and give you all personal, excuse me, work email accounts, so to speak, for your work here as city council members. If they are in your personal devices, the courts don't care. Is it part of your job as a council member? Then it's a public record. And those records have to be retained pursuant to those records retention laws. There's a records retention schedule for just about everything. The good news is, you know, for your world and for, like, you know, law enforcement records, it usually comes down to 5 or 6 different specific ones. But you should know what those are. Talk with your clerk, who's probably also the records retention officer. Yep, about what that would be. Delete records. There are these things called transitory records that you don't have to save at all. My to-do list that I do, there is no retention value to that. Once I get to track everything off, I can deep six that in the recycling can. The post-it note I make while I'm on the phone to remind myself of something, I can toss that out when it's done. You don't have to save everything. Save things for just as long as you need to, then get rid of them. You'll make, when you get a public records request, it'll make your production that much better, that much easier. And with that, you get to check both boxes. You'll get a great certificate that says you're good for 4 years. You can answer any other random questions. I'm happy. I'm weird. I really like this topic. Yes, sir, Mayor.
Okay, so there's the liability of the agency, and then there's the elected governing body. Does the elected governing body carry any personal liability with regard to public records requests, or just the agency?
It's all the agency. You sit at the top of the triangle, so to speak. But you know, if you decided that I don't care about public records anymore, and there was a headline out of Richland recently about a school board member went on the radio and said, "I'm deleting stuff." That's agency liability if it's true. And if there was response, obviously there's lots of factors in that. Is it responsive to a public records request? Was there a request at the time? Because I didn't mention this, but I'll double back. It's all records that exist as of the moment you get that request. It's not for future records. And so that's, you know, if you get that public records request, you get the email saying, "Hey, we have a request for all information about the city pool." Don't start deleting records. That will go poorly for the agency, and it's agency liability.
How about, like, say if she calls me on my personal phone? I mean, there's nothing that they can.
There's no record.
Okay, other than she called me, there's a.
But the call log is not probably, if she called you on your personal phone from the desk phone here at the office. It's probably not a record for that, and you probably have your contract with, you know, T-Mobile or Verizon, wherever your carrier is. That, unless you're producing your billing statement for reimbursement or something like that, there was a case out of Tacoma that said that's between you and Verizon, so to speak. That's not a public record. The city hasn't used that for any reason.
Okay, but then a text message is different.
Text message may be different. The text message that says, "Please give me a call." There's probably no retention value in that, and I would delete those. If you got a much longer message that read, like, you know, I saw one in a headline I was reading this morning that went on for like four screens. That starts to look like it's something substantive and needs to be saved. I'm a huge fan of pick up the phone. I'm a huge fan of walk down the hall. I've gotten some phone calls from folks who complained about agencies not creating records. Nothing says, in absence of some very specific requirements, there is no general requirement that you memorialize everything you do. There's things that should be in other statutes, but the PRA doesn't say that you have to write everything down. It just says, and the courts have said, you know, there's been requesters that have said, you know, you didn't save something for the records retention statutes. Therefore, they should have had it, but they don't, so find a PRA violation. The courts have said, nope, didn't exist at the day you made their request. They didn't have to produce it.
So deleted. If you delete them, they don't exist. Doesn't get
it. It depends on.
Right.
Yeah, you may delete your text, and you may think it has no retention value, and it may not, but say you sent the message. You still have a copy of it. If it's responsive, they would get the message from you. They would probably ask, well, what happened to your copy? And you'd say, you know, I deleted it right after I got it because I didn't think it had a retention value. It doesn't exist. They may get a copy from someplace else, but they wouldn't get your copy.
So if that's the case, could they come after
me? Well, they might try, obviously. But the question is, and what the court would ask you is, did the record exist at the moment you got that public records request? And if your response was, no, I had deleted it 3 months ago when I got it because I didn't think it had retention value, then you know, you'd be in litigation over this, but the court, you have to prove that you did it. And I'd probably say, if I was your counsel, I would say, go back and look, make sure it's not there, make sure you actually did, it wasn't living someplace weird. But if it's not there, if it doesn't exist, you're not liable for not producing it. But like I said, they may get a copy from the person who sent it, or and whatnot.
If it's deleted after the request,
it's deleted. Good point, thank you. It all comes down to that trigger moment. When the request pops in, it shows up in the email, what exists in that time. I'm not sure, the other thing to watch out for is automatic, like, does the city have surveillance videos of any place?
Yeah.
That's the area to watch out for. Those typically overwrite every 30 days or right in that ballpark. So if you've got a public records request on day 28, then you need to be able to act quickly, have a plan for snagging those before they get overwritten. Something like that. That was a piece, that was automatic system scare me. So you just have to be ready to act.
Is there any policy we can set in place that says that our surveillance is not, it's just for surveillance, not for retention or something, whatever?
Courts don't care why you have the video, they care it doesn't exist. The courts have been pretty clear that we can't, by our internal rules, declare something not a public record, or declare it not responsive, or create an exemption.
But you mentioned that if it's a rule on 30 days, then I mean, that doesn't, you know, obviously it's not falling under the retention schedule on the document. But within that 30 days, if we get on the 28th, obviously we would have to produce it. But when we don't have an obligation to keep it under secure?
It depends on what's in the video. There are specific retention requirements. Schedules for everything, and video typically has a very short retention schedule. There is expectation, and then are your officers wearing body worn cameras yet?
Body cameras,
whole separate world. Body cams are different, dash cams are different, and whatnot. But general surveillance usually has a pretty tight timeline, and even body worn cameras typically have, and dash cams have, an overwrite capacity. It takes some affirmative action to the officer to pull it off and put it into evidence.com or to, you know, whatever program you're using.
I have a quick question about liability. Back to the question here, we have a question made of the councilman, person text messages, then the text messages deleted, which that's a problem.
That's a problem.
Who is on the hook for that? There's some fine attached to that action.
The city. PRA, the PRA penalties, whereas OPMA is personal liability for U.S. council members, the PRA is agency liability. they may, they're in taking something out of the headlines. There's also currently two or three recall petitions in which down in the Tri-Cities area because of all these issues with public records and records being deleted and the way the city council, the council took action. I don't think I mentioned this, so I'm going to double back on something for a second. The light bulb just went off. Going way back to the beginning, talking about special meetings, I don't think I'd mentioned that if you have a special meeting, you can't add something to the agenda and take it through to final action. You can add stuff to it, say you want to have a discussion about something, that's okay, but you can't then take the final vote and make a decision. Specifically, the OPMA says for agendas and special meetings, you can't put that through to final action. That's what makes them different than regular meetings. Glad you asked that question because it triggered that. I meant to mention that, so thank you.
So I've got a question, and I think I know the answer to it. And if we can piggyback on what Spencer just asked, but if we have an employee that's using personal email for work and we're unaware of it, and we get a public disclosure request for that, and the employee refuses to provide the information, who's on the credit card?
City? The question is, you know, how do you know about it? But what we commonly see is all of a sudden you see an email pop up with, you know, morgan.damaro@gmail.com or something like that. And all of a sudden that, you know, you're reviewing the records, you say, wait a second, even though, part of the search is you think about anybody who might have office, have records, say it's one of your officers having to do with a specific case or investigation. So the request goes to the three officers and say, do you have anything? And the officer says, yeah, but it's from my records, it's not yours. If it's part of his job or part of her job, it's city records. Then the fun is, how do you get them? I've talked with a few attorneys about legal action you could take in those situations. Nice thing about employees is that they're employees, and so you have this, you know, this employment relationship, and so you can give them directives and whatnot and encourage them to get there. Council members are a little bit different because who are you accountable to? You're accountable to the public, and I just keep picking on the mayor this evening. Say you, in that scenario, you decided I'm not doing it. What's the, your other council members could censure you and basically say, we disagree with you, but that may not change your actions and whatnot. So elected officials
are creating liability for the city.
You're creating liability for the city, and you may be subject to a recall petition. There have been recall petitions filed because of people not following through with their PRA obligations. But that's what's different from employees versus electeds.
When does $100 a day stop?
It stops when the records are produced.
And if they're not produced?
At some point, then when the judge enters the order saying, here's the penalty for that. And it's, at some point, I've had this conversation with folks about if you have like one bad actor, at what point do you throw them on the bus? It's proved that the city did everything it could do. In terms of talk to the employee, you know, discipline the employee, fire the employee. At some point, you talk to people about you just have to own that mistake
and then try to get it to court in the trial so you can stop the clock.
Stop the clock. And there are tools within the PRA that, you know, you can, once the lawsuit's filed, that you can push that through the court and not just have it. Because there are some litigants who, obviously, they're at that point. If the case takes 2 years, that's just 2 more years of penalties. There are tools inside litigation that you can ask the judge to make that final determination. Another tool that agencies have is you can do what's called an offer of judgment, which basically say, we admit the violation and we're agreed to pay you $2,000, $20,000, whatever the number is. And then if they don't do better than that in litigation, they don't get their attorney's fees. And so it's kind of, it's a litigation strategy as well.
Anything else? Morgan, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for
and thank you for giving hypotheticals and having conversations. It's much more enjoyable than me just talking for an hour.
True. That was brilliant, Brendan. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Moving to item 5. In our agenda is unfinished business. Is there any unfinished business to come before the city council tonight? New business, is there any new business, item six? Okay, I have one item. Former longtime fellow city councilman Everett Cole passed last week. He'd been on the city council for 28 years. His service is Friday at 11 a.m. at the Othello Nazarene Church. If any of you council or members of the public would like to attend. I gave him a Distinguished Service Award, I think in December during COVID. He had been on a board in the city of Othello for 60 consecutive years. So, yeah, we just want to mention his passing and thank him for all of his years of service to the city council and recognize that service. Then item seven is council will also receive the city clerk report. And having no further business to come before the council, I'd like to adjourn the meeting tonight at 7:55 p.m.